This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, last week we talked about the Supreme Court not listening to an expedited hearing about the Affordable Care Act. This week they came out and said they won't consider an earlier challenge to the law, instead opting to allow the case to proceed through the normal channels.
And that doesn't mean that they won't be hearing the case. It just means they won't be hearing it soon. This has been quite a season for long delays on almost everything that we expect to see coming out of Washington. So we'll have to watch closely as the case moves through the appellate courts.
Hurry, hurry, wait, wait. And we're all familiar with that. And meanwhile, the Supreme Court is hearing another case that could have an interesting effect on healthcare and beyond. Vermont passed a law that would prohibit pharmacies from selling information about which drug doctors prescribe most to pharmaceutical companies. This has implications beyond how pharmaceutical companies market to doctors, since any decision could impact how other forms of data are gathered and sold.
Well, the pharmaceutical company had its hits over the last month or so with their progesterone drug to prevent preterm labor, and now this. Another topic we've been following closely that's made some news, reactions to the proposed restructuring of Medicare in the Republican budget proposal. We were wondering when we'd see that reaction.
That's right, Margaret. A few weeks ago, we were wondering where all the town hall meetings with seniors telling their representatives to keep their hands off of Medicare were, and in light of the recent budget proposals put forth by Representative Paul Ryan, which includes privatizing Medicare. Well, over the Easter recess, we started hearing the beginnings of some rumbling. Republican lawmakers have been back in their home districts, and some of them have really been feeling the heat from their constituents.
And I don't think anybody is surprised by that. Certainly, entitlement reform, especially of Medicare, has always been very politically sensitive. And a recent poll from the Washington Post ABC News found that hasn't changed much. The majority of Americans, two-thirds, still say they want Medicare to stay the way it is. So convincing the public that the Republican proposal for reforming Medicare is a good idea is going to be quite the uphill battle.
And although the Republican plan is supposed to privatize Medicare for the next generation of seniors, it seems like many of the outspoken seniors at these recent town hall events were skeptical of the Republicans' promise that they would remain protected. This is a big turnaround from the town hall debates 2 years ago when President Obama's health care plan was on the table.
And in these early months of the next presidential campaign, I think we can now call this the early month of the next presidential campaign. The president was on the road last week. He was criticizing the Republican plan, and the Democrats have launched a media campaign accusing Republican House members of doing away with Medicare and putting retirees in danger.
Well, health care will remain in the bullseye for the campaign season, and we will keep an eye on it here at Conversations on Healthcare.
And any way you can cut it, what we do know is everybody, all politicians, have to be figuring out the best way to rein in healthcare costs. And really, that's on the national agenda for all of us.
That leads us to today's guest. We're happy that Dr. John Wenberg is here to help us today. Dr. Wenberg is the Peggy Y. Thompson Professor for the Evaluative Clinical Sciences at Dartmouth College and founder of the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice, which houses the well-known Dartmouth Atlas Project. We look forward to speaking with Dr. Wenberg about his research, which for the past 40 years has focused on variations in healthcare around the country and what we can learn from him about making the healthcare delivery system more equitable and efficient.
We're very glad to have Dr. Wenberg with us today. And no matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. Subscribe to iTunes and get the show downloaded. Or if you want to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of our show, visit us at chcradio.com. And if you're a social media aficionado, become a fan of Conversations on Healthcare on Facebook. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio. We'd love to hear from you. Before we speak with Dr. Wenberg, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, with headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. The First Family made sure that health and wellness was central in this year's annual Easter egg roll.
In addition to listening to some great music and dancing a little bit, you can roll your eggs, you can do some yoga, you can play with some, do some obstacle courses, play basketball and tennis.
Under the theme Get Up and Go, the festivities on the South Lawn were part of First Lady Michelle Obama's Let's Move initiative to bring awareness to healthy eating and activities for children. The Supreme Court said they won't consider an early challenge to the healthcare law. Virginia's request to expedite the review of the law was turned down by the Supreme Court. It offered no reasoning, and there were no noted dissenting votes. The Supreme Court's usual practice is to consider cases only after an appeals court has ruled. The Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit in Richmond, Virginia, will hear arguments in the Virginia case on May 10th. The Department of Health and Human Services has decided to award quality bonuses to hundreds of Medicare Advantage plans rated with the average 3 or 3.5 stars. Roughly 1/4 of Medicare beneficiaries are enrolled in Medicare Advantage plans. They offer lower out-of-pocket costs and more comprehensive benefits than the traditional program. President Obama's health care law gradually cuts $145 billion over 10 years from Medicare Advantage, starting in 2012, mostly to correct a problem with overpayments to the plans. Medicare has classified the bonuses as a demonstration program, relying on broad legal authority Congress gave to the agency to experiment with quality improvements. The money will come from the Medicare Trust Fund.
This is Conversations in Healthcare. Today, we're speaking with Dr. John Wenberg, Peggy Y. Thompson, professor for the Evaluative Clinical Sciences at Dartmouth and founder and director emeritus of the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice, as well as the founding editor of the Dartmouth Atlas. His latest book, Tracking Medicine, A Researcher's Quest to Understanding Healthcare, is published by Oxford Press. Welcome, Dr. Wenberg. Your career for the last 40 years, which is chronicled in your book, has focused on the variations in healthcare across the country and its effects on the health of individual patients. What exactly is the study of practice variation, which you also call the science of healthcare, and why have you found it so important through the years? And tell me, does my zip code really matter in the type of and quality of healthcare that I receive?
But let me start with the basic observation is that if you compare the healthcare in one community to another, and you take the trouble to adjust for the different factors that might explain it on the basis of illness or patient preferences, you end up with huge differences between the amount of healthcare received by population A and population B, and they can be right in neighboring communities. We first ran across this in Vermont, where we looked at a whole bunch of different attributes of the healthcare system. The one that sticks out in most people's mind is the incredible variation that we saw in tonsillectomy rates, where literally by going 5 miles up the road and entering a new hospital service area, you could jump from about a 20% risk of having a tonsil out by age 15 to well over 60%. So that gives you an idea of what the basic variability was. And this variation simply could not be explained on the basis of differences in the incidence of sore throats or tonsillitis or anything like that. And it was traced pretty much directly back to the medical opinion of the physicians in the different communities.
Dr. Wenberg, I think that certainly gives us a hook on looking at these variations. And certainly you've made the point that illness doesn't explain it all, and nor does any one factor, not genetics or environment or age or anything else, I guess. But when you try and understand these variations across the country so that we can build some effective health policy and practice procedures, it seems that you're left always looking at the Medicare data because that's what we've got on a national basis, and yet you use the example of tonsillectomy, and I know hysterectomy was another one, and certainly less than Medicare age people often. How do you get at the data on the rest of the country, on other special populations like Medicaid and the commercial population, so that we have a complete sense of what is going on with variation?
Well, what the earlier studies that we did in Vermont and Maine and Rhode Island and in Iowa and some in actually in California were all based on 100% hospital discharge data. So we were looking at both 65 and under 65. And certainly we found then, and there's still plenty of evidence that this is true, is that the experience of older people, those 65 and older, when it comes to surgical variation, pretty much mimics that of the under 65 or vice versa.
Dr. Wenberg, we're having that deja vu moment again in our country when we're fixated on the federal budget deficit and rapidly increasing healthcare expenditures. And obviously in the crosshairs is Medicare. What can the politicians learn from your research about the most beneficial ways to restructure Medicare and how to contain costs while providing the best outcomes that are possible?
Politicians would have to understand that not all healthcare is the same. Some things that vary do so because they are essentially measures done to improve the quality of life, and patients have different preferences for those treatments. The only policy way I know of getting at the which rate is right question is to actively involve the patient in the decision process, because after all, it's the patient's preferences that need to be driving the decision, not medical opinion, opinion of local physicians. And at this time in our history, we can certainly see in the patterns of variation that it's medical opinion, not patient opinion or preferences that is driving these. Now, that's just one of the categories. And I'd say in terms of Medicare, that makes up about 25, maybe 30% of cost, those kinds of procedures. Mm-hmm. Most of it's basically going for managing chronic illness, for managing patients who ultimately are going to succumb from their diseases. So it's the long-term management of chronic illness that is where most of the money in Medicare goes. I'd say about 30%, 60% would be a pretty good estimate. And here, the variation that we see around the country is driven primarily by the differences in frequency with which chronically ill patients visit their physicians, are referred to specialists, are hospitalized, are put in intensive care units, receive MRIs or other forms of imaging and other laboratory tests. So it's the intensity of care, which differs so much from one community to another, which also is the driver of costs. So if we want to deal with costs in Medicare and the trends upwards, we've got to somehow figure out how to deal with supply-sensitive care to bring now chaotic way we manage chronic illness over time under some form of organized systems. The organized systems, such as the Mayo Clinic and Intermountain Healthcare, Geisinger Clinic, do much better in terms of continuity of care over time. They use fewer resources and spend less money. And I don't think it's not just an accident. It's the organized system that's there that permits the timely trade-off between primary care and specialists and the judicious use of hospitals and results in lower overall costs.
Well, that seems like a mountain to climb if we only have four organizations that you can cite and we have 100,000 people providing health care out there, or a multiple of that. What's the crosswalk over for the system that will get us to develop world-class organizations who are focused in on patient outcomes and not always about volume and bottom line.
Right. Well, that is the bottom line question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Health Reform Act does have the so-called accountable care organizations, which could be viewed as a bridge to the future, and the sense that it provides opportunities for fee-for-service medicine to become more organized, to begin to move towards a budgeted approach, and to develop the infrastructures necessary to really manage chronic illness over time. And I might add also the infrastructure to make certain that the concept of shared decision-making and informed patient choice gets implemented for surgical procedures and other conditions or treatments that are definitely preference sensitive.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. John Wenberg, the Peggy Thompson Professor for the Evaluative Clinical Sciences at Dartmouth, founder and director emeritus of the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. Dr. Wenberg, you mentioned the Affordable Care Act, and certainly it gives our nation an opportunity to reform the delivery of healthcare, but I will tell you that one of the most remarkable outcomes of the work of the Dartmouth Atlas, and I think it was brought to the public consciousness probably through Dr. Gawande's New Yorker article looking at McAllen, Texas, is that it was the first time I saw this issue of variation in price, variation in utilization make sense to the person in the street, if you will. Our own local Chamber of Commerce sponsored a workshop shortly thereafter with the business community to talk about the Atlas, about these variations, and looked at our own local communities in the state of Connecticut to try and make sense of why these variations happen. Is this a sea change that you're now seeing where business people, chambers of commerce, consumers are finally engaged in this discussion and get that variations may not be so good for your health either?
I think that's really incredible sea change. And let's keep the sea moving. The Dartmouth Atlas was started in the early 90s when we were assuming that the Clinton health plan would come through, and we got support in order to show what the regional differences were because it was so organized around regions. When it failed, basically, we had data, we had an atlas, but we didn't have a customer base. And what we hoped would be that if we could begin to publish this information and do it consistently over time, that ultimately it would surface as a major issue. And it would probably be timed to the next health reform cycle, which, in fact, that's pretty much what's happened. So, yes, I really think these conversations are happening. We see it in the press coverage of the Atlas. We're getting reports of all sorts of feedback and discussions going on. I think we've gotten beyond the death panel kind of problem that we saw a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. People are beginning to take very seriously the end-of-life variation, the cancer treatment intensity varying so much as it does from place to place. We're getting debates over end-of-life care. We're getting debates over efficiency of chronic disease management. And I think that's the essential start to some strong consensus, I believe, that has to come out of this.
Dr. Wenberg, certainly in terms of cultural changes, here on the show, we like to talk about the next generation of healthcare providers and how they're being trained. And so talk to us a little bit about is the science of variation being taught at these institutions, and what can we do on the side of training that next generation to help address some of the structural problems that you've identified?
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the most disappointing features of the trip so far, is that medical education is so hidebound to the traditions of the 19th century in terms of what's taught, who teaches, what's important, and there's basically very little room for the science of healthcare delivery in the modern medical school curriculum. And this is a shame because this is where we've got to somehow, the cultural change is going to happen ultimately when the providers themselves change.
You know, I want to pull the thread a little on the issue of how we inform, how we have an informed consumer out there. And I don't know if there's an app out there or if we start with sort of a sesame level education drive in our country to make consumers more discerning in their selection of providers and selection of procedures that are done. What are your thoughts about, what do you see as models out there that we should be looking at?
We've spent a lot of time figuring out how decision aids, properly designed and properly structured into everyday practice, could in fact change the dynamic, essentially change the culture at the doctor-patient level. And there's a large number of clinical trials now showing that decision aids properly implemented really do change the dynamic and lead to decisions that are higher quality, high quality decision being one in which the patient was truly informed about the treatment options and the risks and benefits, and also where the patient was invited into the decision process so that his or her preferences for one outcome or the other, a lumpectomy or a mastectomy or a knee replacement or some more conservative treatment, their preferences for those kinds of treatment outcomes drove the decision process. And there's plenty of evidence that this works, and it could be implemented broadly, but to do that, it's going to take both push, and I hear again, I think the business community has a lot to say about it, but also push from CMS and also push from provider leaders, for which there are some emerging.
You know, Dr. Weinberg, I was struck by your reference to the organized systems, certainly Geisinger, Kaiser, Group Health, the Mayo Clinic, and as Mark noted, people often tend to speak of those in the same sequence. But when we look at other large systems of care around the health center, our perspective would certainly be the country's community health centers represent another somewhat different but somewhat organized system with 1,000 health centers caring for 20 million people. Certainly the VA represents another large organized system. And I want to tie this back to the education and training issue, because certainly medicine is not alone among the health professions in the hide-boundedness, if that's a word, of how things are taught. But it seems to us that it's the residency is where people get trained to a model of care. And we've certainly been active proponents of we train nurse practitioner residents in our organization. Certainly many health centers have medicine residencies, but that's where you get to train people to a model of care. And I'm curious as to whether you and your colleagues are working with residency directors around the country to make these changes at that level, around things like shared decision making, for instance, which certainly seems to be a core competency for anybody doing a primary care residency training.
The only thing that we can note is that so many of our residency programs are held in hospitals that do not practice shared decision making, mm-hmm. and even perhaps more problematic, they are practicing a brand of medicine in managing chronic illness that basically is unsustainable in terms of the resources they use. Now, that's not true of all teaching hospitals. University of Washington, University of Oregon are all on the low side of the chronic disease management spectrum. Residents there presumably are getting a different brand of medicine than people who are trained at NYU, New York University Hospital, or other teaching hospitals in New York or Miami or Philadelphia. Concern about that issue, particularly concern about the mix between primary care and specialists, does need to become a public policy issue, and we should not continue to fund postgraduate medical education without reference to the content and the environment and the context in which that care is being given. At least that's my opinion.
Dr. Weinberg, when you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovations, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
Some of the best systems I've seen, for example, would be in New Zealand, where they have solved the problem, at least they've satisfied on the problem of financial incentives. Mm-hmm. They've got good IT systems. They're organizing chronic disease management on a continuum involving both primary physicians and medical specialists. So there, I think, you know, you see some systems that are doing things in a very promising way.
Today, we've been speaking with Dr. John Weinberg, the Peggy Y. Thompson Professor for the Evaluative Clinical Sciences at Dartmouth and the founding editor of the Dartmouth Atlas. Dr. Weinberg, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations today.
Hey, you're welcome.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea puts the community front and center in an effort to fight childhood obesity. Although adults in Colorado are the leanest in the nation, obesity among children in that state is rising at an alarming rate. Today, 22% of Colorado's 10 to 14-year-olds are overweight or obese. A nonprofit group called 2040 Partners for Health is bringing several communities in Colorado together to confront this issue. The group has decided to start working in 5 Denver neighborhoods where the childhood obesity rate is 30%. With the help of researchers from the University of Colorado, the team is using an approach known as community-based participatory research, which puts residents in charge of defining their own problems and finding solutions. Researchers started out surveying families in the 5 neighborhoods who had children between the ages of 10 and 14. They charted height and weight and asked questions about neighborhood safety and physical activity. They went into neighborhood schools and did the same. Next, they asked adults and children for their input on how to make neighborhoods healthier. The children requested that school playgrounds be open after hours, and many parents suggested healthier school lunches and neighborhood recreation center. In the community, the message has been well received and meaningful action is starting to build. More than 60 community members have signed up to participate in healthy advocacy in their neighborhood. It may take years for many of these ideas to be fully implemented, but policymakers in Colorado Colorado are beginning to understand what these neighborhoods need to be healthier, an approach to health that's transforming neighborhoods by engaging residents. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.